Please give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Jim from Into Action Home Group.
So I just have to start off by saying that our speaker coordinator is David Fenn. He gave me a call today at 2:30. I said, oh my gosh, David's calling me in the middle of the afternoon. I picked it up. He's like, hey, do you want to speak tonight? I'm like, oh, rookie move. I shouldn't have answered.
So, that's why.
So we'll start off. This is my second time speaking, so this is going to be rough. Just letting you guys know. Where did it all begin? So my name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic.
Jim.
My home group is Into Action. I have a sponsor. I have a service position in my home group. I'm a secretary, and I'm also taking care of the website. I'm on step four. So, I don't know if I'm missing anything there. All right, so the highlights. So it starts off when I'm two, my parents get divorced. This is not going to be one of those fun presentations. This is going to be one of those sad ones. So my parents get divorced when I'm two, and I grew up, and it took a while, but somewhere around six or seven, I realized I was different. You know, everyone else had dads, and I'm like, you know, I don't know what my dad does. And I would make up stories, like we'd be on the bus, and they'd be like, what does your dad do? And there'd be like an insurance building. I'm like, he works right there. I'm like, that's where he works. I'm like, oh, he's an insurance salesman. I'd be like, I don't know what it is. Turns out he was a Marine. So they get divorced. I end up developing a lot of resentment towards my biological father. I only saw him twice. Last time I saw him physically was when I was five. I talked to him on the phone twice. This will come up in a little bit. And I had some letters from him for him. But I had some letters from him, that's it. I really didn't interact with him. And then he died very young when I was 24. He was 56. So, had a lot of resentment from feeling abandoned as a kid. And then my mom remarried. My stepfather was, I think I would call him a good provider. Like, we were solidly lower blue collar, but I never went without a meal. Our house was always heated. We didn't have AC in Rochester, New York, but it was fun. You know, I mean, we were poor, but everyone else in my neighborhood was poor as well. So I didn't know the difference that, you know, we were poor because I had nothing else to compare it to. But I really resented him, probably because I was picking up on my older sister's resentment of him, and I'm like, well, you know, I guess I'm supposed to resent too. So I ended up carrying that resentment forward a long period of time. So that meant that I had this huge hole in my life of validation. Okay, come on in. And really, the way I dealt with validation was, I realized that, you know, if I excel academically, I can get validation. And people would say, oh, hey, you did a good job. You know, you did well on this project. So I dove into academics, and I'm like, you know, I'm going to be the best student I can be. I did very well academically, and this very specifically sticks out. I was applying to colleges, and I got into Annapolis, and I got into West Point, and my dad was a career Marine officer. You know, enlisted, warrant officer, hand officer, finished his career as an officer. Was in Vietnam, and I called him up. This is the last time I spoke to him. Never forget this conversation. I was like, Dad, you know, I got into West Point. And all he had to say was, good job, I'm proud of you. You know, it's tough. And he said, well, you chose a really hard life. That was the whole conversation. So I kept that with me. One of the things I like to do is stew, so I'm a big stewer, so I kept that close to my heart, that resentment, and I let that stew for a long time. And if there is one place that will take every drop of ounce of strength that you have and demand more, it's the military. So I get to West Point, and I do well academically there. And now I've got my validation, and all of a sudden I have a purpose. They give you a purpose there. Like, oh, your job is to go out and defend the country. Your job is to win our wars. That's a very intimidating history at West Point. And while I'm at West Point, I basically take my first drink. So I should point out, I had church wine prior to that point, but it was horrible, and I never really drank in high school as a kid. I get to, this will come in later on, my parents switched from Catholicism to super evangelicalism. So when I say that, it's hard for me to sort of characterize how different it was. I'll give you one idea. One Sunday we spent 8 hours at church. Not all of it was in service, but 60% of it was in service. And the other 2 hours we were just talking to good friends. A lot of big social events. I didn't have any friends there because I was the only kid of my age, plus or minus 6 years. So it was a very lonely time going to church. So I sort of pushed God out for a while. If you asked me if I believed in God back then, I would have said, sure, you know, I believe in God, you know, why not? Everyone else does. But I think if I was pressed on it, I'd be like, well, I don't know, there seems to be all these problems. Like, you know, love one another, and they're getting into fights in church. And I'm like, ah, this doesn't make any sense. I don't get it. I haven't thought about it really well. So now I'm in college. Excelling academically, so now I have validation, I have purpose, and throughout all this time, I still have this, you know, massive hole in my life. I still don't feel good about myself, and by all outward appearances, I'm doing really well. I mean, you get all sorts of accolades, and, you know, everybody comes there and thinks you guys are great. Kind of a weird fairy tale place. So while I'm there, we have a football game and we go to, it was at Rutgers, of all places. And the Army football team, if you don't know, is horrible. So we're there for the football game, but really we're there just to have a party, because at West Point you can't party on the campus. It's not allowed. So we go there, and it's my first time with alcohol, and I get very, very, very drunk. And this lasts about, from beginning to end, if it was an hour and a half, I'd be surprised. It was very quick, very drunk. And then I threw up, and then I passed out. And I woke up the next morning with a hangover, really bad hangover. And I swore to myself, I'm never going to drink again. And one of the key things here is I didn't like the taste of beer. And, you know, back in the early 90s, the beer was horrible. It was really bad. So we had, and we were poor, so we bought cheap beer. So we had, you know, we had the Beast, and we had PBR, which I think is horrible. And my friend would always tell me, well, I want a blue ribbon, so it's got to be pretty good. And then we had the worst beer in the entire world, if you're interested in what it is, called Genesee Cream Ale. It's from Rochester, New York.
Yep.
And if you go online, it's literally the cheapest case of beer you can buy in the United States. It's horrible. And so that's what I grew up on. So beer was not, I didn't like it because it didn't taste good, especially the stuff we bought. So that was a pattern I had throughout my last few years at in college, is that anytime we get away, we would drink the excess every time. But it was pretty random, like maybe once a month or once every 2 or 3 months. It wasn't very often. It wasn't consistent. I certainly didn't think I was a problem. It was a problem. So then, you know, after West Point, I end up going to a series of military schools. So I'm getting that validation one more time. I'm jumping out of airplanes, I'm going to Ranger School, and I'm pulling out of helicopters. I'm doing all of these schools to give myself validation, to feel better about myself, to assure myself that I fit in. And by all outward appearances, I fit in. Like, I am walking around with, I was in aviation, so I was a helicopter pilot. I'm a helicopter pilot, and I have all of these infantry badges. It's hard to explain, but that gives you more prestige than just being an infantry officer with infantry badges. So all of this really intense training, and when I'm in flight school, you really don't have too many opportunities to train, because you're flying, there's rules and all that kind of stuff. So I didn't really drink a whole lot. And then I put down out of flight school, I'm like, listen, I just want to go to one of these three places. I want to go to Panama, or Honduras, or Germany. I'm so excited to go to one of those places. Please give me one of those places. And the Army said, you got it. And I went to South Korea. And they put me up at the the northern border of South Korea. We used to call it, there was a no smile line. So if you were stationed above Seoul, it was a miserable place. There was nothing there. And I was in an attack helicopter battalion. And all you did was you either flew or you waited to fly. You were the alert company. Or you drank. But here's the interesting thing about Korea, unlike other military units, is when we all drank as a unit. So my company commander would literally say, okay, listen guys, tonight we're not the alert company, we're coming up, everybody is going downrange. We would go to this place called the Tea Club, Together Club, and we would take all, we're aviation companies, we're small in the army, we'd take all 65 people, and we would just go to this club. It was so big that you have, you know, there's different tables, and people are sitting at the bar and all around. And I had one experience that really tied into drinking, so much so that I should just explain this. So I'm sitting there and I'm drinking too much. And for whatever reason, there was these two infantry lieutenants. I'm an aviation lieutenant. And I'm just talking, I don't know why I did this. I was talking trash about Ranger School. I'm like, well, anybody can graduate from Ranger School. You can't graduate from flight school. So anyways, absolutely inappropriate. They stand up, but they're going to get into a fight. And I'm like, all right, and I stand up. Well, anyways, my entire company is there, and they go like this. They're like, huh? So like 65 people all stand up at one time. So these two infantry lieutenants go from, like, we're going to beat the crap out of you two. Yeah, we'll do this outside. So, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I found my family. Like, the Army is my family. These guys stood up for me when I needed them. I didn't have to ask. They were there for me. And it involves drinking. Drinking is how you form a family in the Army. That's what I took away from that experience. It gets better though. So while you're over there, we don't have call signs like the Air Force or Navy has call signs, but we had nicknames. I'll just start off this saying that the nicknames over there were all negative. So we had one guy that was Monkey Boy, he was really hairy. We had another guy we called Lip because he had a cold sore for like 3 weeks, so we thought that was funny. We called another one Fat Boy because he was fat. So my nickname, and this is going to sound cool, but it's not. My nickname was Hitman. And the reason why they got Hitman is because when I would get drunk, I would do stupid things and make everyone laugh. So one of my buddies said, oh my God, Hitman, you're killing me. And that's how I got called Hitman the rest of the time. But it was because every time I got drunk, I did crazy stuff. So here's an example of doing the wrong thing in the military. Company commander said he wanted railroad ties for around our headquarters building. Right, we don't know where to get those. So my sister platoon leader, also now in AA, said, hey, I know a great place to find them. It's the Division Support Command, 06 headquarters. They have them around their headquarters. We're just going to go take them from their headquarters. I'm like, this is great. Two lieutenants talking. I'm like, that sounds like stealing. He's like, no, man, it's Army property. We're just moving it from over there to over here. We haven't stolen anything. I'm like, all right, let's do that. So we get a Humvee, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning, we go over there, and we rip out like 12 of these railroad ties from in front of their headquarters. Next morning, we have a battalion run, and we're running over like Camp Casey, and there's the discount commander with all of his staff looking at the gap in his railroad ties, and I'm like, oh my God, we're going to get an Article 15 for this. No repercussions, no Article 15, nobody found out about it. So my battalion commander, that was a decide. My battalion commander while I was over there was, I'm going to have to speed this up, we'll skip that. On my way out, I was drinking a lot at my farewell, and I had already seen my report card, and it was good. Like, I got it. Good job. While I was there, I was drunk, and I literally told the battalion commander, you know, thanks for letting me be a platoon leader. I just wish we had seen eye to eye. I don't know why I said that. I was drunk. Anyways, I came into his office the next day. I no longer had a good report card. I actually had a bad. And I was like, whoa. I didn't tie it to the drinking at all. I tied it to the fact that he was a jerk. And he was a jerk, but I mean, you shouldn't say that to your boss, even if he's a jerk. So I get out of Korea this idea that the Army's trying to validate me, the Army needs to give me purpose. I'm still feeling hollow inside. I still don't feel like I'm successful. And then, same thing, I put down my wish sheet. I'm like, listen, I really want to go to Panama, Honduras, and Germany. And the Army said, this gets better. The Army said, okay, you're going to Hawaii. So I end up in Hawaii, and I get there, and I'm like, wow. I mean, going from South Korea to Hawaii is like night and day. It was like paradise. I still love that place. And I get there, and I'm really working on my PT. You can't tell now, but I used to be super fit. So I was running marathons. I was, I was in a 2 meter roll again, and I was doing really great because I'd already done it. And then I end up thinking, maybe I can do this Army thing. Like, this is not that hard. I'm gonna, try really hard. And I did really well there. And unlike Korea, where you go drinking every 3 weeks, in Hawaii, you can't do that. The unit's not as tight, because everyone's got their own home and their own house, and they go home after work. So my drinking kind of takes a low point at that point. While I'm there, I eventually contact a friend of mine from college. I'm back in the States. I visit her in Indiana, go back to Hawaii. She comes and visits me for a month. She moves to Hawaii. A month later, 2 years later, we're married. I think at that point in time, hey David.
Hello.
I think at that point in time, I had gotten to the point where every time, oh please come on. Every time we went out to eat, I would drink and I would have just too much. Not a ton, just too much. So if I should have had one beer, maybe two beers if we were there for a while, I would have three beers or four beers. Not enough to be jerk, not enough to be unruly, but you shouldn't be having four beers when you're going out with your own for your anniversary. So that starts my pattern. I then end up going to grad school, teaching at West Point, and all through this time, I feel like my career is going really well. I'm getting a lot of validation, everything's going really well. I volunteer to go to Iraq, this is great. So the Army's like, hey, we need your particular skill set in Iraq right now. I'm like, oh my gosh, sign me up. The war's gonna be over, I gotta get over there before it's over. So I get over there, and the first thing they tell me is like, that job went away. So, we need you to do this job, and this job was holding a meeting every other week. At one meeting, 1 hour meeting. It was important, but it wasn't that important. It was approving money. But I was really depressed when I got there. I mean, I was like, what just happened? I gave up a job I loved teaching. I came here, it was horrible. I hated, I was forming this resentment towards the Army. And then on my way out of Iraq, I ended up at Joint Forces Command in Suffolk, which is no longer there, Joint Staff, whatever it's called now. It was J7, J8, J9 over by the Walmart, or something by College Drive. And while I was there, I got accepted into the PhD program. This is part of the Army said, hey, we want you to go get your PhD. I'm like, oh, amazing, this is gonna be so great. I'm gonna get my career back on track, this is gonna be awesome. I love academics, perfect. And so then I take this letter to my team, and they're like, you can't leave. Because you're in a joint billet, and you have to stay there for 3 years. Mm. And like any good alcoholic, I'm like, well, I'm out of here. So I left the Army after 14 years of service. So I was in a pretty low place at that point, and my drinking starts to pick up. Not terribly, but it becomes daily. So I start to drink. I can't remember what there were bigger bottles, maybe two big bottles of beer a day. It wasn't horrible, but it became every day. And then on certain occasions, I would drink even more. So this goes on for a while. And then I am feeling like I don't have a purpose. I left the military. I don't have a purpose. I'm not getting validation for my job. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, what am I doing? And I get a call. Somebody had seen my resume and said, hey, are you interested in going to Afghanistan as a contractor? I was like, you know, it's going to take this much amount of money. I gave him a number that was three times my current salary. And he says, well, let me call you back tomorrow and find out. And he calls me back and he goes, okay, done. So then I'm thinking, I should have called him four times. So I end up going to Afghanistan, and while I'm over in Afghanistan, I developed this application that's used for monitoring counterintelligence case files. And it ends up going across the entire country, except for Southwest, which is where the Marines are, because they don't do anything for anybody else. They do their own thing every time. So I get all this validation again, and now I'm getting paid tons of money, like unbelievable sums of money. I'm getting all this validation. I'm getting a purpose, because, you know, we're over there, we're doing the right things. I'm helping out the military. I don't know if we could say that the military, you're doing great things. Here's one of my favorite stories. Not to do with drinking, but it is inside. While we were over there, some soldiers accidentally burned a Quran in the incinerator, and some locals saw that. It's horrible. But while this is going on, the Stars and Stripes are taking pictures of a protest at the front gate. And there were protesters that were like shouting, you know, death to infidels and that kind of stuff. And one of them, in the front page of the Stars and Stripes, had a New York Yankees hat on, a Harley Davidson t-shirt, saying death to America. And I'm like, man, we have definitely had an impact over here. So what ends up in Afghanistan is I'm staying over there for 6 months. I come back for 2 weeks. And when I'm back for 2 weeks, the party is on, the game is on. I am drinking as much as I can, smoking as many cigars. Well, now I have money, so now I can buy the good stuff. Like, whatever I want, I can buy. There's no limit. And as soon as I hit Dubai on the way back, I'm drinking. And they have a huge selection. Mm-hmm. And I come back, and I have 2 weeks there, and I go back in the country in 6 months. And while I'm over there, I'm, you know, restless, irritable, and discontented. Even though I have the money, I have you know, like validation of this project that I've done, this grassroots, it's done so great things, and I just feel empty inside. Well, this goes on for, I end up spending about 3.5 years over there over the course of a 5 year period. And I come back, and I'm really frazzled at that point. I'm, you know, really worn thin. I'm working on this new project, and I send an email to this GS-13. I thought I was being, you know, I won't say polite, but, you know, not assholish, and I send an email with the word, you know, F star, 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 star. And I sent that off. And in Afghanistan, it would have been a big deal. Back in the States, it's a big deal. So that happened on a Wednesday. I was fired on a Monday. And I went from, at that point in time, I was working 80 hours a week, drinking a bottle of wine a night, and going to D.C. once a week. So Tuesday and Wednesday, I was in D.C., coming down, and just pushing as hard as I possibly could. So when that happened, you know, rightfully so, but in my mind, I was like, you know, I'm working this hard for the Army, for our country, for our people. I put all this time and effort in, and I've done all these great things, and I cannot believe I'm being punished for this one thing. You know, it's somebody else's fault. It's not my fault. It's their fault. And I was, that really, that was the beginning of a slow decline until it became a fast decline. So that began drinking quite a bit more. I would say routinely a bottle of wine or a bottle and a half of wine. Sometimes right around that point in time, I started coming out with those the 9% beers that were like loaded with sugar. That stuff was fantastic. So then you could have four of those, and that's like the equivalent of, I don't know, like eight regular beers. So I started drinking and drinking and drinking. And I end up having all these other experiences too. I end up starting this company. Once again, I'm getting paid a lot of money. The company goes under because of interpersonal problems. Also due to alcohol, fortunately not my alcohol. It was a good friend of mine. They would get into it. And that company dries up. And I end up working for another company for the big boss. Feasibility. And I'm working on this other company, and I don't like what they're doing. I think like the business model is going to fail, but I'm kind of stuck here because I promised them I work there. And I'm like, well, I'm getting paid a lot of money, but I don't have any validation, I don't have any sense of purpose. And I start drinking more and more and more. And then favorite event for any alcoholic, COVID hits. Now I'm not traveling anywhere. I'm sitting at home and I start drinking earlier and earlier in the day. So I used to drink, I used to have a rule, never drink before 5 p.m. And then I'm like, never drink between 4:45 p.m. And then it just kept on getting earlier and earlier and earlier. I ended up in this cycle where I would drink, I'd go to sleep, and I'd wake up in the morning feeling awful, like just horrible, and telling myself, oh, you've got to stop drinking. All right, today's the day you're going to stop drinking. And then 12 o'clock, like 2 p.m., I'd be like, oh, okay, I feel okay. I'm like, I'm a little bit off. No would help. I'm just going to have just one drink. That's it. I'll have that one drink, and then that's it. Like, and then tomorrow, I'm going to quit. And of course, I would have one drink, and the very next thing is I would go to the store and get two more, get three more, get four more. And I'd end up with six beers or eight beers. So during this time, I'm going to tell one last story before we get to the important stuff. I end up leaving that job. It was paying so well, but I didn't feel validated. And I'm like, you know, I'm going to get alcohol tests. I'm going to do it on my own. So I took up options trading. So in the first month, I went from $50,000 to $150,000. And I was thinking, you know, baby, I am back. I have done it. And I am drinking my ass off. Constantly drinking while I'm trading. And if some of you are thinking that doesn't sound like a good idea, it is not a good idea. So I continued to make money, and then in one day, this is roughly 28 hours, I lose $75,000. If I had it all been sober, I could have gotten out of that for about $12,000. And $75,000 was like, whoosh. Like, and then I got to go to my wife and say, no, it's not my fault, the markets were bad. And then she's like, you got to go and get a real job. So I'm sitting there and I, you know, the option stuff didn't work out. I've got to go back and get a job. And I'm like, ah. So what do? I solve it with drinking. So I'm like, let me drink right now and I'll solve this problem in a week. And then like a week goes by and another week goes by. And here's, I don't know why this happened to this day. I can't tell you why. I think it's absolutely divine. But I'm sitting there. My wife on Mondays works until roughly 8 or 8:30 p.m. And I was already toasting. I had already had at that point two bottles of wine and six of those big beers. Probably meaning don't not even drink them. And I remember we were sitting on the couch. And up until this point, I should mention that, you know, I was routinely hiding my alcohol. Oh yeah, I also had four kids, I got divorced. This is the second one, I forgot about that. And I was hiding my alcohol from my second wife because I didn't want her to know that I was this guy who drank all this stuff. So I hid all my alcohol. I lied about it all the time. Like every once in a while, she'd be like, are you drunk? Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, no. And in my head, I'd be like, I need to stop talking right now. If I slur, she's going to know I'm drunk. And I'd be like, oh, like, and I'd just be like, all right. Because I was absolutely slurring. So I sat down on the couch and I said, I got to tell you something. And she's like, what? And I said, you know, I've got a problem with drinking. And she goes, what do you mean? And I said, well, I drink a lot every day. I didn't think I was an alcoholic, but I said, I drink a lot every day. She's like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you know, today I've had two bottles of wine and six of these big beers. And she goes, what are you talking about? So that's when I show her where I hid my wine. My favorite place is behind the bookcase and I have a special shelf where I have the beer cans. And I would have all these elaborate schemes to get alcohol in the house or get it by her or, you know, trying to open up a beer can so that no one would hear it. So I'd be like, oh, I got to go to the bathroom. And then you go to the bathroom and you're like, nice. I'd be opening it up and then downing it all. And then, but I showed her all that. And she's a therapist, I should mention that. So she sits down and she's like, first of all, she thought her marriage was over. She's like, oh my God, what have you been doing? You've been lying to me this whole time. And I'm like, yes. Like, I've been lying to you since before we were dating. I lied to you, you know, when we got married, you know, Every time I asked you to go out to dinner, that's because I wanted to get good booze. I wanted to get good alcohol. So she's like, you have to go to AA. And I'm like, at this point, I'm just like, marriage is going to fall apart again. Like, I mean, my first marriage fell apart because, large part because of alcoholism. And I'm, so the next day, I literally, and I Google, and I'm like, AA, near me. And this pops up. And I, at this point, I am like, broken. Like, my job is horrible. I am miserable. I have no validation. I have no sense of purpose. My new wife is like looking at me like I'm, like she has no idea who I am. I wouldn't say I'm estranged from my kids at this point, but we weren't on great talking terms. There's a lot of friction going on there. And I end up here, end up at the In Action Group. And I showed up like a few minutes after they started because I just assumed alcoholics don't start on time. And we're sitting down, and I have no idea what AA is about. I really thought, you know, you guys are just going to give me some pointers on how I could drink like one or two drinks a day, and, you know, that would be how I get through this process. So, and then everyone is has like slogans, like they're all like they're in the right place, and you know, and then they're collecting money and they're reading from a book, but it's not the Bible, but they're quoting from it, and I'm like, what is this? Like, I thought it was going to be like some sort of therapy session, and I had no idea what AA was about. So luckily I got a sponsor that night, and I think that is probably the most critical component of my first 60 days, because I was in full out resistance mode. The only thing that kept me going in AA was my sponsor and my wife telling me, you have to do AA, dot, dot, dot. So I'm there, I'm sober for the first time in a long time, and I am restless, irritable, and disconnected. I am angry, I'm miserable, I'm like, and during this time, I started a new job. And I am resisting AA to the best of my ability. When I first started at AA, I would literally say, you know, everyone says, you know, I'm Jim, I'm an alcoholic. I would say, I'm Jim, I might be an alcoholic. I'm like, you know, I drink a lot, but you guys are the real alcoholics. I heard your stories, and I'm like, 7 DUIs? Like, I'm not that guy. I mean, I was driving around drunk all the time, 100%. And I'm driving with one eye closed, but I don't, you know, you guys are real serious drinkers. I'm like, I just need to get help with that. So I'm pushing back, and then I just had this image in my head, and I've shared this before, but basically I felt like I was in the bottom of a hole, and everybody at the meetings has a flashlight. And I'm looking up, and everyone at the meeting's got their flashlight. They're pointing at this ladder, like, look, here's a way out. Just take that ladder out of the hole. And I'm down there, and I'm like, no, I'm good. I'm okay. And that goes on for a while. But then at some point, I'm like, oh, fine. Let me just do the first couple of steps. Let me just do it. So I get up there, and then I get this nagging idea. I'm like, maybe they have something. You know, they're not 100% right, but maybe there's something there. Maybe there's just a piece of truth that I missed out on, and they're saying something, but I'm not sure about it. And at this point, you know, my faith in God is non-existent. So one of the things my sponsor had me do was to start praying every day. And when I started praying, I didn't believe in God. Like, I would literally start my prayer like, if you're there, here's what I've been told to say. And but after a little while, it started to feel real. And right about that time where, you know, I'm struggling with AA, I'm sober for about 60 days from now, my ex-wife calls me up and says that my oldest son has been voluntarily committed into a behavioral health at Sentara. for depression and suicidal ideation. So I go there, and he's in there for, I think it's either 7 or 10 days, and he comes out of there, and he gets misdiagnosed with bipolar, and they give him lithium, which is a very significant disease.
Drug.
Medicine for certain diseases, but bipolar, they generally don't use that anymore. So anyways, he went from being in a poor condition to being a hellacious condition. And within 3 weeks, he was voluntarily checked back into OBC, and he told my ex-wife, why don't you just let me die? And, you know, this is my son who was the valedictorian of his high school class at Kingsport. IB program, UVA freshman, computer science, 3.9. Like, I'm like, what is going on? So, I'm praying the next day, and I'm like, God, I'm like, you can have it all. Just save my son. That day, we talked to a new set of nurse practitioners, and no matter what you believe in your higher power, I think this was divine, but her name was Angel. And at that point in time, I needed a sign. And she was the first person that was listening to us in weeks. We were telling them that something is wrong. And if you ever have to deal with the behavioral health system in the United States, all I can say is get involved as quickly as possible, because it is a screwed up system. From top to bottom, it is horrible. Anyways, we found a good nurse practitioner. She started listening to us. We got his meds changed, and he started to improve. He went from, you know, telling us that he wanted to kill himself within, now this is, there was also PHPs and IOPs and therapy and psychiatric visits. And I don't want to say that this happened, you know, all of a sudden. But probably within a 3-month period, he went from that very low to being basically back to his old self. And it was extraordinary. And today he's doing great. He just got a 4.0 in his last semester. He's doing really well, very good. And that's on top of the fact this kid has had a rough year. He had, he was diagnosed with adult onset epilepsy in November. And he had multiple seizures before he got the medication right. And he is just the champ. So when I look at that whole experience there, and, you know, that was when I decided, okay, I got to stop dicking around, and I've got to start doing this correctly. So for me, I went to Mass, I went to confession, and I literally was in there for a long time. And I went from stealing gum in first grade all the way through to the reason I told my priest everything. And if you're unfamiliar with confession, at the end there's a penance that you have to do, somewhere at AA, and I'm like, oh, this is going to be so bad, because I mean, I've done all these horrible, horrible things. We just hit the tip of the iceberg here. I've done all these terrible things. He's going to tell me this awful thing, and this broke me, because he said, your penance is 1 hour, Father. And I was like, you know, I just had told him 43 years of confession. And I was just like, that, you know, that's the kind of acceptance that I needed at that point in time. So at that point in time, after that confession, you can take this for what it's worth. The next morning I was praying, and I felt a sense of peace that was not in my physical body, and it was not in my spirit. And I've never felt anything like it before, or since. I can't explain it, but I know it existed. And once that occurred, I knew I had to get right with God permanently. I can't do this one foot in, one foot out. I have to be 100% in. I told him I'd do it, and now I'm going to do it. So at that point in time, you know, I continued to work through. And I was still struggling with AA. And, you know, I prayed on it. And I felt like God was telling me that You just have to be patient. And then a little bit after that, like around the 6 month mark, I felt like he was saying, I think I need to go. And you're saying, no, you have more to learn. So that's where I'm at right now, is I'm in the more to learn stage. As far as the steps, after that experience, I went from being, I might be an alcoholic, to understanding my disease. So my disease was had a physical component, I had cravings, I drank too much, I know I can never drink again. But I also had a huge mental component of just wanting validation and wanting purpose in my life. And I feel like after that moment, I felt that peace, like that just fell away from me. And my life's not perfect, it's far from it. What I like to think about is the cobwebs, or, you know, before this happened, I was walking through life with sunglasses where I couldn't really see out of them. So my physical life, I couldn't see out of them. My mental life, I couldn't see out of them. My spiritual life, I couldn't see out of them. I removed the alcohol from all that, and now my glasses are clear. And some things get better, like my physical body got better within about 9 days. Compared to, it's still not good. Compared to where I was when I was drinking, I started sleeping through the night. I started not having headaches in the morning. And I'm like, is this how other people live? Like, I mean, this is crazy good. Like, I'm really digging this part of it. But then the other part of it was when I looked at my social relationships, I had devastated relationships with my children. Really had, my current wife was, it was improving because I was in AA and I made this change. And then with my ex-wife, there are things that still needed to be worked out. So I made that change. And for step two and step three, for me, it really revolved around, you know, I have to give up my will. And I still struggle with this. I struggle with it every day. You know, what is my will? What's God's will? You know, does God really want me to have a new car? So I continue to struggle with that. But I have come away with a lot of great things from AA. The first thing I have is my relationships with my kids have improved across the board. I can't even explain it now, but my oldest daughter has a better relationship with me than she does her mother, which is weird because all of my kids resented me for so long. And I can't even explain. It's just my whole demeanor changed, and I think she reflected that, and now we meet about once every 2 weeks to have dinner, and, you know, we really connect. I think the other thing to change is, you know, I have many defects, but I think two of my biggest ones are pride and selfishness. And my pride, like I would say to my kids, I'm proud of you after a soccer game before, but now what I say is, you know, I love you, and I say that, you know, you did a really great job in that soccer. It's not about me, it's about you. I try to, you know, put the focus on where it's supposed to be. The other thing, this is, sounds so weird. Like I could see myself from like 14 months ago mocking my current self, and I'm gonna say this. And I enjoy praying. So I pray about 30 minutes every day, and on Saturdays, sometimes I'm getting a little bit more. And I like it. Like it makes me feel better. And if you had told me that 14 months ago, I would have been, you're a sucker. Like, no way, you are making this up, or you're faking it. But it has changed my life. And that's a practice I will take forward forever. The other thing I'm super grateful for is I believe that, you know, God showed me AA, and AA showed me God. And I cannot say that enough. Because I wish I was here earlier in my life, but I know if I had continued on that path, I would have been dead by now. I had a friend from Afghanistan, a very close friend, who died an alcoholic death in October. when I was drinking, he had called up and he had said, we have a third friend, JD, who had, out of his own willpower, just stopped drinking, the combat controller. And he goes, how did JD stop drinking? And I'm like, I think he just did a cold turkey. And you could literally hear the defeat in his voice. He was looking for any other answer besides that. And I'm like, you know, we're all heavy drinkers. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. But to this day, I wish I had the knowledge I had today, because maybe it would turn out different. Because he really was an exceptional guy. He left the Army, got divorced, and that was it. He just gave up his life. The last thing I would say is I have my current family, which has improved. My relationship with my wife, right around the 6 to 8 month mark, she said something to me, and she goes, you know, I've always loved you, but I like you again. And what she meant was, for a long period of time, I was basically an asshole, and I didn't treat her very well. Not horrible, but my thing is sarcasm, my thing is cynicism. I'll make a joke out of it, but it's just on the edge of that line, or sometimes crossing that line, and it gets me. And I've really been able to tamp that down. I'm not perfect. I've really been able to tamp that down and, you know, try to get a hold of how I respond to the people I'm supposed to be taking care of. And at this point in time, my relationship with my ex-wife has tons of work to do, but I can at least say, after all the crap that went on, that she deserved a better version of me in our marriage, especially in the last 5 years. I was horrible to her, and that led to some other ramifications, but I don't know if it's ever going to be repaired, but I will say this. I think that there might be a way. I think that, you know, give it to God, and we'll figure out if he's got a plan for it. With that said, I believe the most significant parts for me early in the program were the meetings, my sponsor, and this daily spiritual practice. I think later on in the program, it's a daily spiritual practice. I enjoy the meetings. Like, I did not enjoy the meetings in the beginning. Now I enjoy the most of them, at least. And I find that there's a tremendous amount of wisdom in the meetings. Like, not just about AA, but life, about how we interact with people, especially when things get difficult. So, that's my story. Thanks for letting me share.